This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. Today we hear from journalist Marianne Pearl, the widow of Daniel Pearl, who was kidnapped and beheaded by Islamic extremists in Pakistan in 2002. That story, from her perspective, is told in the film A Mighty Heart, which opens next week, starring Angelina Jolie. It's based on Marianne Pearl's own book of the same name. Daniel Pearl was the South Asia bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal. When Marianne last saw him, he was on his way to a meeting with the radical Islamic cleric Sheikh Mubarak Ali Shah Jilani in the hopes of investigating his connection with the shoe bomber Richard Reid. In July of 2002, a special anti-terrorism court in Pakistan found Ahmed Omar Sheikh and three accomplices guilty of Daniel Pearl's kidnapping and murder. Omar Sheikh, who organized the kidnapping, was sentenced to death, the other three to life imprisonment. They are appealing, and the investigation into Pearl's murder continues. At a military tribunal in Guantanamo last March, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the mastermind of the September 11th attacks, confessed to decapitating Pearl. Marianne Pearl, also a reporter, was working in Pakistan for French public television and radio when her husband was killed. She was 6 months pregnant at the time. Here's a clip from A Mighty Heart, which opens next week. Marianne, played by Angelina Jolie, is being interviewed on CNN. Her husband has been kidnapped, but not yet killed.
Mrs. Pearl, the group holding your husband have given a 24-hour deadline for the United States to meet their demands, or else they say that they'll kill your husband, Daniel. Do you have a message to that group?
Yeah, I have a message. Three different points I want to talk about. The first one is that I want to remind them that my husband and I are both journalists. We are two people who met and fell in love because we have the same ideal. He's someone who I never saw him say a lie. In his journalism, I've never seen anyone so honest.
And how are you coping with this?
I haven't slept for 6 days, if that's what you're asking. But I have hope. You know, I am not desperate because I believe that if I stop trying to create this dialogue, then I stop believing in everything else. And I can't do that. I'm pregnant.
And if you could say one thing to your husband now, what would you tell him?
I love you.
Angelina Jolie is Marianne Pearl in the film A Mighty Heart. Terry Gross interviewed Pearl in 2003 when her book about the life and death of her husband was published.
Before your husband decided to actually take the risk and meet with a disciple of Sheikh Jilani, he asked people for advice, and the advice he basically got was, it's okay as long as you meet him in a public place.
Right.
Was he confident, was your husband confident that if he met Jilani in a public place that he'd be safe? And was he confident that their meeting would really be in a public place?
Danny was absolutely confident that that meeting with someone who could be dangerous in a public place was a safe way to go, because that's what we do all the time. That's the only way you can actually approach those people. And because he had asked those questions to three different people, I am sure that he remained confident that the meeting would happen in that restaurant where they had their appointment.
Now, you write in your book that you and your husband used to signal each other when you were alone, that you'd like to report together, and you usually accompanied each other. But when you couldn't, you'd signal each other so that, you know, you'd be able to relay to the other that, you know, that you were safe or that he was safe. When did you realize, after not hearing from your husband, that chances were he wasn't safe?
Very quickly, because there was some kind of sensation that I had that made me feel uncomfortable. So I started calling him. We would usually call each other every 90 minutes. That was the standard time. But I started calling him before. Like, I just wanted some kind of reassurance. Something in me was uncomfortable. So very quickly I started calling, and the phone was off. I don't know if it was off or if it was out of range, but this voice kept coming back, and Danny would not answer. So very quickly, his meeting was at, I think, 7, and at 8 o'clock I started calling, actually.
Now, some people say, well, you know, Daniel Pearl took a risk that he probably shouldn't have taken in meeting with this man. And, you know, if he were more experienced, if he would have thought more about it, he wouldn't have taken that kind of risk. And you say in your book that he always played it really safe, and he refused to be a war correspondent. He didn't want to be in a war zone. When the Wall Street Journal, his newspaper, wanted to send him from Islamabad into Afghanistan after September 11th, he refused to go. And he even wrote a memo to the Wall Street Journal outlining several of the reasons why he didn't want to go. What were some of the reasons why he thought he was basically accusing the paper of not looking out enough for the safety of its reporters in war zones.
Yes, Terry, let me first tell you that if Danny had just made a mistake, I would admit it. You know, I would be honest enough to admit that day he just got carried away, because it's just a human thing to do. But it's not true. Danny was a really safe, safety conscious person, definitely more than I am. Everybody does that kind of thing when they work as foreign correspondent. You just report. That's what you do. Otherwise, you can't work, or you just stay in a hotel room and then you pretend you report. So that there was no options there. As far as the Wall Street Journal is concerned, Danny, to just let you know that I'm not inventing that, he wrote this safety memo because, contrary to what people say, he was an experienced journalist and he had covered dangerous zones. And after one of them in Kosovo, he had written a safety memo to the Wall Street Journal saying, yes, you send us there, but you don't even remember that you're sending us to war, because that was his own experience. He had been in Kosovo, and when he talked to his boss back in New York, the person said, oh, I forgot where you are, right? So then he was really angry at that, and he wrote a memo that was for his safety, but for all foreign correspondents' safety. And it was a very detailed memo saying, we need that to be out of danger.
You know, one of the things he said in that memo was, several times I've told my editor or the news assistant that I'll be checking in daily and they should call if they don't hear from me. But when I went a few days without checking in, I never got a call.
Right. That's one of the examples. He was asking for check-ins. He was asking for equipment. He was asking for cash, just elements that would and training and safety training. And even, he's even talking about kidnapping situation. So he's asking more training because he's saying basically that the Wall Street Journal, in a way, positions itself as a newspaper that's not news. It's a newspaper, but it's like more economic, and it doesn't go to war. It doesn't go on the front line. And it was, obviously wrong. We were in the front line and we were mandated there. So it was obviously wrong.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Marianne Pearl, the journalist who is now the widow of Daniel Pearl, the reporter from the Wall Street Journal, who was killed by Islamic radicals in Pakistan. When your husband was missing and you knew he was in serious trouble, you wanted to convince his kidnappers to release him. You were about 6 months pregnant at the time. The journalists of the world were trying to interview you. What were some of the things you thought about in deciding what your public role should be and how you should publicly present yourself, in a way that could possibly help save your husband?
Right. The only thought I had in my head when we decided that I should try to make a public appearance on television was, maybe Danny's watching me. Which means the way I wanted to present myself is communicate with him and say, I'm here, like I'm strong, like I'm with you, we are together, and I wanted to convey that message to him, that I was not destroyed or anything like that, that the baby was fine. So that was my main concern, and my only concern, really. I also thought, if he's watching me, then his captors also are watching me. To these people also, I am going to tell them, if you think you've taken everything away from me, it's wrong. You're not achieving your aim, which is, they were trying to terrify you. So I was not terrified. I was just trying to have a language of common sense. And I thought, based on my experience of talking with these people, that was the best thing to do, as opposed to, be crying on TV.
Did you think that it would be possible to get sympathy from the terrorists because you and your husband were expecting a baby.
I did not think I could expect sympathy from terrorists. The only thing I could hope was that they were publicity hungry and they wanted a lot of attention, and then they'll release Danny because that was their plan in the first place. That's the only thing I could hope for. The people who have destroyed 3,000 lives in the World Trade Center, of people who had not done nothing to them and they were completely innocent, would not release Danny because I was pregnant. I knew that since day one.
You got a series of 4 photographs of your husband before he was executed. Would you just describe those photos?
When we received those photos, we were all waiting for signs. We had been without any kind of message for 3 days. I was surrounded by people that helped me read those photos. Those photos, the first one was Danny with a gun pointed on his head, and he had his head down. You could see, it's a very strange picture because you can see he's smiling. Which is, of course, a message, the same message that I would have had on television, right, by being strong. The second photo is him with shackles on his hand, but he's also doing the finger, giving the finger, you say, I think?
Yeah.
And on 2 of those pictures. So in all of them, he managed to communicate his state of mind and his strength and everything, his love and his defiance. So it was at the same time, of course, scary to see him with a gun pointed at his head, but at the same time, it was very comforting because I knew he was exactly in the same state of mind than I was.
His execution was videotaped, and at the end, he's on tape saying, "My father is Jewish, my mother is Jewish, I am Jewish." Do you think he was told to say that?
I think he might have been told to say that, he was Jewish. But what he wasn't told, because that wouldn't have been possible, was that his grandfather had a street named after him in a little village in Israel. And so that's an information that only his family could know, only I could know. And that's his way of saying, I am proud of who I am, and that's how I'm going to die.
Do you think a lot about the attitude with which he faced death, and when you think about his attitude, do you find that comforting or upsetting?
Oh, his attitude is very comforting. I mean, it's so comforting, it may not be the right word, but I constantly come back to that moment when faced he couldn't avoid his death, there was nothing he could do, but faced by people who wanted to kill him for who he was, he decided to be proud of who he was. That strength and that courage he had is something I always come back to in mind to go on with my life or to do what I have to do. And, when I'm very too sad, I just always come back to that moment and gather strength from it.
How did you find out that he was executed?
I found out because the video was out for 2 weeks. We didn't know what had happened, and then suddenly the video was out, was released by the people who had edited it. So the FBI had a call and received the video, and all the investigative team went to Randall Bennett's house, was one of the investigators, and watched the video and authenticated it. So then they came back to the house and they told me.
That video ended up on the internet. At least one news organization played part of it. Can you talk a little bit about your reaction to the circulation of the video?
The reason why they killed Danny the way they killed him, beheaded him, and taped this whole his murder was to the sole purpose was to show that video and terrify people. So it was a strategy. of course, you know, they send out those tapes to news organizations and put it on the internet because that was their point, that was their goal. Now, it was up to the news organization to decide what to do with these images. The fact that they had at least one news organization, which is CBS, decided to broadcast it was very sad, not so much because... it's because it's vulgar, but more because that's exactly what the terrorists wanted them to do. And that the fact that they didn't understand that for a country that had just been hit by terrorism so hard, that made me angry, very angry.
What about the vulgar aspects of it? What about the aspect that there are people in the country who saw your husband being beheaded on video?
You know, there is a dark side or animal side in human beings that are attracted to, those kind of images. It's like lower instincts, right? Basic instincts. You can appeal to that because that, you know, generates interest, generates money, generates viewing and ratings. It's a responsibility to broadcast those images, you know. And the only reason that I found on the internet, because there were people chatting about it, should they do it, should they not do it, the only reason for it was freedom of expression. It's completely wrong. That's not a freedom of expression. That's pure, pure animal instinct, the same way there are videos about people being murdered, I mean, all kinds of other murders or rapes or that kind of, that's how low it is. There's nothing there. There's nothing there in terms of, the reason that was explained to me was it's newsworthy, and it wasn't newsworthy, you know. It was no news. Like, we knew what had happened to Danny. It was just, voyeurism. I don't know the word in English. It's, when you want to...
Voyeurism.
Voyeurism, exactly.
How has the kidnapping and murder of your husband affected your willingness to travel or the kind of journalism that you practice?
It made me more determined to do what we did together. One of my challenges, what I did for me to survive was that I listed all the goals that the terrorists had. I did the opposite of CBS, and I decided to deny them all those goals. So one of those goals was to instill fear in me of traveling, of others, of make me lose my confidence. And I fought very hard so that they wouldn't achieve that goal. So I'm still very much interested by the human race and our world. And Danny taught me so much about good journalism and objectivity and truth. I will definitely go on.
Marianne Pearl, I really want to thank you for talking with us.
Thank you.
Marianne Pearl speaking to Terry Gross in 2003. Her book about the life and death of her husband, A Mighty Heart, has been made into a movie that will be released next week. Angelina Jolie stars as Marianne Pearl.